I'm going to call this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for the February 13th meeting. Is there anybody who would like to move approval?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Okay, Representative Bonner, thank you, moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The minutes are approved. The first bill on the agenda is House File 3068. Chair Dean, I thought I saw him earlier. Okay, he apparently just left the room. Okay, Chair Dean.
I might need to watch him.
I was thinking that. So just so members are aware, these bills have all the bills on the agenda for today have been heard in the election subcommittee. So I'm going to, you know, there has been a full discussion and testimony there. If there is anyone who'd like to testify, I will certainly give them the opportunity, and there will be opportunity for member discussions. But I will try to kind of move things along quickly so we don't rehash issues that have already been addressed in the election subcommittee. So with that note, I will move House File 3068 to the Ways and Means Committee. Do I have that correct? Okay. So Chair Dean, would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Chair Freiberg and members. There's also an amendment as well?
Yes, I will move the A2 amendment. Would you like to describe the amendment? Is this just to put the bill kind of in the shape you like?
Yes, there's some language that we thought was critical to make sure that the bill ultimately intended to do what we wanted to do. One of those has to do with some other things, and I think Mr. Gehring could speak directly to that, Mr. Chair, if he's so willing.
Sure, Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the amendment does two sort of substantive things. The first part of the amendment from lines 1.2 to 1.6 requires the Secretary of State to destroy data maintained in the statewide voter registration system after the list is provided to a political party chair, and then requires the party to provide a written confirmation that can be used then to initiate that destruction. And then the second part of the amendment from 1.7 to 1.9 clarifies the penalties that would apply. So in the Data Practices Act, there are both civil penalties and criminal penalties. And the language here just clarifies that the political parties and their designated representative will be subject to those penalties as provided in the law.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Any additional discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. The amendment carries. Chair Dean, would you like to describe the bill briefly?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So House File 3068 is in response to some action that we took previously as a legislature regarding the presidential national primary, which will actually take place 2 weeks from today. I want to thank you for bringing this bill before us quickly so that hopefully we can assure voters that their data is secure and can't be used completely. And, you know, we got to the presidential national primary because the caucuses were starting to get pretty long. I think in 2008 we had many people standing outside. There was a lot of sort of activities around people wanting to engage in the caucus process. And that happened again in 2016. You know, in 2008, we can maybe say that that was one party, but I think in 2016, there were several individuals in both parties that were running for the nomination. And although this is a election that will encompass what some people will say is the party's business, whether it's the GOP or the DFL, this is definitely one of those things that the voters of Minnesota thought that we should move to a primary, and a primary that actually is facilitated through our elections process in the state of Minnesota is the best way to do it. And we set that up, excuse me, a few years ago. And as we found out that the way in which what we had passed and how it's being interpreted, that the data of all the people that voted, because we're doing a primary that requires you to designate your party at the time of choosing a ballot, which is unusual for Minnesota because We haven't really done that. And, you know, we know how Minnesota voters feel about their privacy of their vote. You know, all of us have probably made calls and talked to individuals and asked them how they're voting and have gotten the response, well, that's private. I don't tell people how I vote. So in the process of setting this up, the system, we allow that data to be shared from all of the parties to all of the parties with very little restrictions on what they can actually do with that particular data. So the intent of 3068 is to clarify that, you know, this information will only be made available to the chairs of each major political party in the state upon request. It's not something that's shared automatically. And it's to a designated single representative of the party's national committee. It will restrict the use of the list to verify the compliance relative to their nomination process for the candidacy of presidents, and prohibits further distribution. As I mentioned, current law doesn't restrict how they can use this. In addition, 3068 puts in place a voter opt-out for their name to be included as part of the data set that will be provided to these particular parties. So individual voters will have the opportunity of signing a document to ask not to have their information included in that data set. So that's what 3068 does. We've got a little bit of time to get this done to assure voters that we've taken all precautions at protecting their data relative to the election for the presidential national primary. And I'd be open to questions, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Ranking Member Quam, is your question to the presentation, or do you mind if we take testimony first?
It is to the presentation, because I was confused when the author of the bill stated that, you know, identify what party, and that's unusual. And in fact, I attended my first caucus at age of 17, and every caucus that I've attended, it is identified. You do identify what party you're in. And the presidential preference that we've done year in, year out, you are identifying because you're attending the caucus, you're writing down your name, your address, and other information, which is then disseminated. So actually your bill would change it from how we normally do an activity. And that's why, you know, he stated some things that are contrary to my life experience from a youth through present day in our caucus system in this state of Minnesota.
Chair Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam. You're absolutely right. In the past, we would go to the caucus, we would sign in, we would voice our preference ballot for the president, but that information wasn't made available to all parties. It was something that was internal to the parties, as well as in that process, it was never really determined that, you know, a community member or someone on a school board or elected official in a city, that information would be out there and available to the public. And what the goal of this is to put some guardrails on so that information doesn't get shared. You know, we've been told by many individuals that work in the state of Minnesota, I think our House research staff has even said that they're not likely to vote because of this information. You know that they do a great job of maintaining a nonpartisanship in the way that they approach how they assist us in doing our work every day. So you're right. There, you know, if someone stood outside your precinct caucus with a camera in the old days, they could determine which precinct caucus you were going to, and they could identify you to a particular party. But that's very different than having a list that could possibly be widely distributed that would include individuals' names as well as the party for which they chose to select their ballot.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, question for you. How are you going to enforce compliance to list destruction. There's nothing in the in your bill that has any follow-up by anybody to guarantee that that has actually happened. And second question, or how are you gonna track major parties' use of any list? Because let's say everybody in this room's preference gets put into the hands of the two major or four major political parties, sorry. How do we know that there's any difference between that list and a list of just voters that you can get from the Secretary of State file? How are you going to track and say, hey, you're a bad actor and we're going to come and, you know, drop the hammer on you? How are you going to enforce that? Because there's nothing in your bill that has anything about enforcement.
Chair Dean.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg and Representative Nash. Actually, there is. If you look at the Section B, there is an issue that the list can't be distributed to any person or used for any other purpose. A person who violates this paragraph is subject to the remedies and penalties provided in Sections 13.08 and 13.09. So there are some penalties. The question is, you might ask, well, are those penalties extreme enough to prohibit someone from doing that? There is a request letter that will actually attest to what the parties are available to use that information for. And in signing that request, that will be outlined to them for what they can use that for. Now, regarding what we are going to do if they violate that, well, that would be, I believe 1309 would apply to the particular parties.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dean, that wasn't the question at all. There's nothing in here that says you can buy a list from the Secretary of State of registered voters, right? We all
Mr.
know that?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay, so how do you differentiate between a major party acquiring someone's name on that list versus the list that you now want to say you have to destroy within a certain time and you can only use for purposes of verifying delegates for seating status at the national convention? Because from where I sit, many of those people are on that list of voters, if not all of them. So how are you going to say, hey, Representative Nelson, your name popped up here, and now we're going to go after somebody else for using the primary voter list that we just obtained? Because you can't tell the difference. There's no DNA that follows that list along anywhere, right?
Chair Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. I believe that the list that the Secretary of State supplies of individuals that vote, that are voters, and what they have voted of do not include any party designation. Okay, and the thing with this actually does have a party designation component. So I think that's the difference. Now, if you want to talk about, running software to do lots of regressions and lots of other things, you can certainly do that now. But I think the intent of voters is assuring them that their information of the party in which they voted would not be something that would be out there circulating out in public.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you. And I'll try to wrap this up because perhaps Representative Dean and I should meet in an office. But so here's the deal. I can append information that I can gain elsewhere and figure out with a good level of probability how people vote. How do you differentiate between me doing that and figuring out that you're a DFL or a Republican or one of the marijuana parties versus this list? Because it's not really spelled out in your bill how you can prove that. And again, there's no language to check up on the Secretary of State deleting the list, and there's no language saying, oh, we're going to double check and see what the parties are doing. I don't see that here, and we didn't talk about it when we were in elections. So if you're really going to do this, and I've hated the idea from the beginning, but you really should expand the bill if you're going to, and have some sort of change order management or some way to say, yep, we know that the file was deleted, because it's really not spelled out at all.
Chair Dean.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, I think that there are many things the Secretary of State does that we don't follow up on to make sure they're doing it. And I think within state government, we do that in many, many areas. I believe that, if the Secretary of State is charged with destroying the data 10 days after in which the request was fulfilled by a party, I'm going to assume that he's going to do that. If you want a report from the Secretary of State to actually do that. This has one more stop in civil law, as well as it will come to the floor, and you certainly have an opportunity to add an amendment to have the Secretary of State make a report regarding that they fulfilled the obligation of the law.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
And Representative Dean, I think you understand where I'm trying to go. Mm-hmm. I have every belief that the Secretary of State will delete it, but if you have an enforcement component of your bill, not just for the Secretary of State, but also for the major parties, then there should be some mechanism that you put in your bill to prove that that actually happened. You should request a report. You should have something in there that says, we know that this happened. Right now you just say they have to. I don't see anything else that says now prove it.
Mr. Chair, I'd
like to phone a friend. Matt Gehring, if you could speak to 1308 and 1309. I'm assuming that these are statutes in place that have some penalties or some mechanism of, I don't want to say harm, but if someone does violate this, there is repercussions that individuals or the state would have.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean and Nash, so section 13.08 is a civil remedies section of the Data Practices Act, and that does allow a person to effectively sue for damages if their damage is a result of the misuse of data. Presumably in a proceeding like that, you'd have to sort out where the data came from and whether it was used improperly or not. There's also an option for a person to sue for an injunction to force the, either to force the Secretary of State to destroy the data or to take some other action to comply with the law. So that would be kind of the process that would be followed under that section. And then in section 1309, that's the criminal penalty. So there would be an option for a misdemeanor prosecution if someone willfully fails to comply with the law.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. I think that answers the question. Representative Bonner, did you want to?
Really doesn't, but that's okay.
Was this to the presentation, or I would like to get to testimony here as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dean. Just one quick clarification for those of at the table, and I know that Representative Nash is well aware of this. There's something called PII, which is personally identifiable information. It's often a term used to describe sensitive information. But what it basically does is it matches up that sensitive data with an actual person. In the case of the voter file, yes, of course we can get a list of folks who voted in the state of Minnesota, but we cannot get their party affiliation at this time. That would be considered sensitive data. And so I think this bill directly is aimed at making sure that those two items are taken care of. And I just want to be clear that this bill does exactly what you do when you have personally identifiable data or sensitive data. Number one, it determines who should have access and limits that access to the data. Number two, it restricts what you can do with that data. And number three, it's giving you an opt-out. So this is actually pretty standard practice for how we deal with data. And as Representative Nash knows as well, while we could certainly ask for a report and Representative or Dean, if you would like to, you certainly could. But I think as part of standard operating procedure for deleting data, there is often a checklist that is followed internally in which that is verified that data has been destroyed. And in this case, it would be in the best interest of the state and the Secretary of State to fend off litigation.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. I'm going to open testimony. Is there anyone who would like to testify on House File 3068? Okay, seeing none, I'll close that. Representative Nash.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonner, I'm not exactly sure that the NIST definition of PII contains voter affiliation. It's not in the NIST definition that I'm currently looking at on the NIST website. I don't believe that voter registration is a component of PII. So it's typically name, address, telephone number, social security number, and other things that are of a particular nature that would be used to identify someone's identity so you can steal it. Having your party affiliation is not something that's going to facilitate stealing your identity.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In meeting with both of my communities, the city councils of both Eagan and Burnsville want something done so that their staff does not have to identify what parties they are. I mean, especially the primary example would be the person that's in charge of elections. Right now, cities and counties are nonpartisan. If these people are going to exercise their right to vote, they will then be identifying what party they are, and that could cause some concern for people in the community. And it also means probably a lot of people will not vote.
Thank you, Chair Mason. Seeing no, I thought I'd give it a shot. Ranking Member Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a clarification for other members, there are some cities and other positions that are partisan. It depends on whether it's a charter or what type of city and the population of the city. And with a bill moving through committees, which would have the councils and others report to the campaign finance board, in those reports would be sufficient information to determine some associations possibly, so that the purity of that data, you know, could be, you know, somewhat discussed. One of the things that we seem to be muddling here is the difference between August or June or whenever we have a regular primary for an office and determining who will be on the ballot in our state, and a party function of taking a preference within the state for the nominee of that party. These caucuses and presidential polls both are party functions. They're not regular elections in the state of Minnesota. The purpose is with the parties, so there's a difference between the two. And you know, one directly determines who we are having on the ballot if you have a challenge within your party for a House position or Senate position. The other, as we can tell with the process before us this year in Iowa and other states, it's a muddled fashion that is determining within the party. So I think we need to delineate that when we have the discussions. The motion before that we're going to vote on, I believe, if it is a financial thing, which if it was going to the Ways and Means Committee, it must be.
It is.
They don't waste their time with policy things. So is this proceeding to State Government Finance, which is the State Government Finance Committee?
The motion is to Ways and Means. Chair Dean, did you have
Chair Freiberg, Representative Quam, we had asked if it was important for this to come to State Government Finance, and they determined that it didn't have to come to State Government Finance. And by going through government operations, elections, and Ways and Means, the thought was that it's covering the bases that it needs to relative to the financing. And, you know, to your commentary prior to that, I think that, you know, muddled is maybe not the right word, but I think clearly this is something that we are doing that's part of a state function, I mean a party function. And that's because the people asked us in the state of Minnesota to do this, and because we as a legislature actually voted to approve this. So what this is attempting to do is to fulfill what the people of Minnesota had requested us to do, a vote of a previous legislature, and trying to set those guardrails to assure the voters of Minnesota that their data was going to be secure relative to this vote in this presidential national primary. So you're absolutely right that this is the state doing a piece, as you know, there are several things in many other states that do presidential national primaries where the state fulfills the function. Because I don't think the parties, whether it's the GOP, the DFL, or the marijuana parties, have the apparatus to actually do a statewide primary vote. So this is one of those areas that the state has stepped in.
Okay. And it looks like Chair Nelson, since his committee was referenced, might have something to say on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The figures that were coming back for the cost of this was on the borderline of what the Ways and Means Chair considers negligible, and the Secretary of State has assured me that they would absorb the cost, so there would be no cost that we'd have to fund going forward because the Secretary of State already has his budget. So therefore, we determined we didn't need to see it because it's going to go to Ways and Means, and then that'll be determined whether it goes to the floor from there.
Okay. Ranking Member Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sort of interested in what those costs are because we had a discussion in the previous committee, say government finance, about the requirement of having to, you know, delineate funds and et cetera for flags for fallen first responders. And in that discussion, the quantity or dollar amount was fairly insignificant. But it was important to have that in that bill and to have that discussed in state government finance where I thought it was in just a few thousand dollars there. Would the author be able to give us an idea of the magnitude of this since it's, I thought it would be more than just a few thousand dollars.
Ranking Member Quam, I'll allow a little latitude. I mean, this isn't a finance committee, so this is being referred to the finance committee where I know these discussions will be fleshed out, but if you have a brief response of some sort.
Chair Freiberg, I'm gonna phone a friend from Secretary of State's office. And you know, the negligible piece, that's an issue related whether it has to go to Ways and Means or not. It's not a question of does it have to go to other committees. So the cost of this will exceed, and as Chair Nelson had mentioned, will be absorbed by the Secretary of State's office. But that cost is in excess of that few thousand dollars, which the Ways and Means Chair generally waives if the negligible cost of a particular bill. So I will allow my testifier to speak to this.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Sam Banowitz, Director of Government Relations with the Office of the Secretary of State. As far as the fiscal considerations for this bill, it would be, I believe it was about $4,000, and that was primarily programming costs to just add an extra field within the statewide voter registration system that indicates that information is protected and would not be put on the list that's provided to the major parties.
Okay. Ranking Member Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question came from sort of a confusion or befuddlement from the discussion in the State Government Finance Committee and here and the relative amounts of what could be ignored and not need to be discussed in one committee and not another. And so, again, you said this isn't the Finance Committee. That's Chair Nelson's committee. But I am still a bit confused as to why it's going to Ways and Means if it's, and not state government finance. But thank you.
Is there any additional member discussion? Okay. Any brief closing remarks, Chair Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Voters have let us know, whether through emails, phone calls, or other things, that they're concerned about voting in this presidential national primary if they believe their data is going to be or get out somehow, some way out into the public. So I think this is one of the ways that we can assure voters in the state of Minnesota that we are doing all we can to make sure that their information and their data is kept private. And I want to thank you, and I hope that you'll support this bill.
Thank you, Chair Dean. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3068, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. I'm going to, thank you, Chair Dean. I'm going to skip ahead in the agenda to a bill that House File 1152, which I happen to be the, you can, oh, I guess you're. Sure.
Sorry, my fault.
Okay, well, we have half a gavel. Don't worry about it. Hopefully we don't need to bang a gavel.
Mr. Chair, I've seen the British courts where they just use just the head of the gavel and they don't have a handle on it. So
we can make a noise up.
We can.
Several instruments.
Don't worry, I got it.
Representative Cagle to the rescue. So I will move that House File 1152 be referred to the General Register. Is that where this is going? Okay. Yes, I'm getting a nod. So House. And we talked about this briefly last year in the context of the election omnibus bill. So House File 1152 is a bill that will increase access to voting for Minnesotans with a disability. It will allow county auditors to send a voter with a disability their ballot materials electronically, the same way our military and overseas voters are able to now. It goes one step further by allowing the voter with a disability to also mark their ballot electronically using whatever access technology they use. The voter would then print their marked ballot and send it back to their local election office. There is still a paper trail. There's no transmitting a marked ballot back electronically. This is about giving voters with a disability equal access to the ballot. As you know, we have no excuses absentee in Minnesota. In the 2018 general election, there were 24% of Minnesotans that took advantage of voting absentee. However, the paper ballot mailed to those who live in mail ballot precincts or who want to vote absentee is not accessible to blind, low vision, and other voters with print disabilities. You and I are able to receive our ballot at home, mark it, and go on with our day. Voters with a disability need assistance, taking away their right to vote privately and independently. This bill would allow those voters equal opportunity to mark their ballot privately and independently at home, just as others can. Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act requires that voters with disabilities must be provided an opportunity to exercise their right to vote that is equal to the opportunity provided to voters without disabilities. And we see this in other states that have had lawsuits. Courts are interpreting that to mean that states must provide an accessible way for blind, low vision, and other print disabled voters to mark their ballot privately and independently at home as well. When an accessible way to vote is not provided, and as a result, a voter with a disability must arrange travel to a remote elections office or an office an hour away in order to vote privately and independently, the opportunity they've been provided to exercise their right to vote is not equal to the opportunity provided to voters without disabilities who are able to mark their ballots at home. Happy to answer questions. I know Ms. Bonowitz.
Do you want to, there is a amendment here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I will move the A1 amendment. It says is that the county auditor or municipal clerk has to provide a return envelope containing first class postage to a voter requesting a ballot and ballot materials under this subdivision.
Amendment to get it in the form you want the
Correct.
Bill to be on. Okay. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The
Thank
amendment
you.
Is now attached, and go ahead and describe either the amendment and or the bill, or have you already?
Yep, I think my opening statement described it pretty well. I know Ms. Bonowitz is available if there are technical questions that arise.
Is there anybody that wants to testify first on this bill? If not, members that have questions?
Are you calling on me?
Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I have probably two different questions. One is, how do you identify who has a disability that qualifies for this?
Sure, I'm gonna call Ms. Bonowitz up here.
Please identify yourself.
Sam Bonowitz with the Office of the Secretary of State. Chair, members, this would be self-certifying as it is in other states as well that have a more accessible absentee voting.
Oh, okay, Mr. Chair, and so if upon your request, you self-identify as having a disability that qualifies for this, is that correct?
Chair, members, that's correct.
Okay, just another follow-up question. So then does that person become part of a list where you would automatically receive an electronic ballot each election?
Chair, members, no, that would not be, it would not be automatic every election. They would have to request that they receive their ballot and ballot materials electronically for each election.
For each election. Okay, one last question, Mr. Chair, if I could. And I think I know the answer, but I'm not sure. So the ballot is sent electronically to the voter, but the voter needs to download that, print it out, mark it, and mail it back. It can't, the vote can't be transferred electronically. Is that correct?
Chair members, correct. So the voter would receive their ballot and ballot materials electronically the same way that military and overseas voters do right now.
Mm-hmm.
This would just go one step further, allowing them to use their accessible technology to mark the ballot. They would then print the ballot. There would be no transmission of a ballot electronically. They would print that ballot and submit it to their local election office.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else? Question? Yes. Ms. Keel.
Tice.
Did I say the right one?
Nope, I'm Tice.
They look alike.
I know. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure exactly who's going to answer this, but I guess I'm a little bit confused. If they're receiving their ballot electronically, but yet the amendment says that we must provide an envelope with postage.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm kind of confused. Why are we sending a postage, you know, I guess that's just a little, I'm confused.
Chair members, so what the amendment does, and this was an amendment that was placed on this bill when it was in the elections omnibus last session, but what it does is because they have to return the ballot in paper form, it makes it clear that they are not the only voters who have to pay for their return postage back to their local election office. So right now, absentee voters and UCAVA voters don't pay for their own postage. So this would just provide them that pre-postage envelope to return it, so they don't have to pay.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically, they can get their ballot electronically, but we're still going to mail out an envelope postage paid for them.
Chair members, that's correct. Yep. So they would be allowed to mark their ballot electronically, and that kind of covers that privacy and independence piece. But then they would have to place it in an envelope to return, correct? Yep.
Okay. I'm still a little fuzzy on that one, whether or not that makes sense to me. But I get the reasoning for it, but we'll just let it go.
Yep.
I'm going to quick.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, we have no electronic transmission of marked ballots. So this is consistent with the state's current practice.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. I'm trying to understand the mechanisms because we're, you know, transmitting electronically. So the registration and request for absentee ballot can also be done electronically. Is that a correct statement? I see a nodding head as a response. So that the follow-up to that question, Mr. Chair, is how do we have verification for the registration, you know, the documentation and et cetera, if you can enlighten me on that process?
Chair members, I'm not certain if I understand the question. Right now, voters are able to register online. They're also able to request absentee ballots online.
Representative Flom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying, being familiar with the normal way of registering, you know, same day registration or registering, there tends to be some, you know, I thought there was some additional verification of, you know, address and other things. And I know if you have an incomplete registration, and you don't show, you know, through HAVA, if you don't show some type of ID, then you verify the last four of the social with the Social Security agency's verification of name, address, and last four. That's a national thing. So how are we, you know, when you electronically register, and I assume that this might not just be for this situation, how is that verification and the checks and balances present?
Chair members, this bill would not impact the security procedures that are in place to verify voter registration right now. You're correct that it's checked against DVS or the Social Security Administration. That would not change. The voter would also be sent a postal verification card. That would not change. And then the postal verification card is non-forwardable. If it was returned to the county office, that would be investigated and potentially forwarded to the county attorney for investigation and potential prosecution. This bill does not change any of that.
Mr. Chair, part of the questioning was to, on the public record and for those that are watching, to have a better feeling of the security of our election system. And so I wanted, you know, somebody just tuning in now to understand what are the processes. And if we send the registration verification card out and it bounces, the timetables then would have it flagged for an absentee coming back. And my curiosity, because we're sending out the ballot electronically, now we have electronic copies of ballots out there. If a nefarious person online, you know, there are data pools out there where they could register a bunch of people. They could request, there's no verification, so you request this type of electronically transmitted ballot. And, you know, so you don't see a person. And what, how are we ensuring that no ballots could be, you know, how are we protecting from fraud? Because I see an opening there. And so I just want some reassurances, not just for myself, but for the people in the audience, that we do have sufficient protections.
Chair, members, like I said, this wouldn't change the verification procedures that happened before and on and after Election Day. To your question about ballots being transmitted electronically, that already happens with military and overseas voters, including students studying abroad, missionaries, military members and their families. So that's already happening. This just extends that same privilege to voters with a disability, allowing them to vote privately and independently the same way that we're able to. But the verification procedures are still in place, like I said, checking against DVS, checking with the Social Security Administration, checking with the courts, and the postal verification card. All of those checks and balances are still in place.
Well, Mr. Chair, I understand that they're in place, but I also understand that the Secretary of State's office and the different county organizations, when asked about the, in 16 and 18, there were over 15,000 one time, 16,000 the other time that came back when verified with the Social Security Administration website as being bad registrations. And that when the Social Security, or when a Secretary of State and the counties were asked, Secretary of State says, well, that's a county's job. And the counties responded, well, we don't have access, so we can't do it. So they basically said, we don't verify. And that when an audit was done, a sampling audit, it was discovered that bad registrations were still voting, and in the hundreds or thousands, depending on how you look at the that process. So we have bad registrations voting, and I'm not sure that we have appropriate safety measures, because frankly the Secretary of State's office says that they don't check it, and the county says that they can't. That means it's not being checked. So I would just hope that maybe when we do election bills, we could try and improve the processes instead of just saying, well, they're the same that we're already doing, but I think there are some weaknesses. And so I would hope maybe that we could improve it with whichever election bill comes forward. I like the idea of the accessibilities. And I like the things that we've done for assisting both on-site, coming to vehicles in the rural area, and this, the intent of this bill. I just wish that we had better checks and balances to reassure that there aren't any hanky-panky things going on, forget the expression. And I know that both Secretary of State and nationally people have complained about the possibility of you know, things going on, especially electronically with foreign entities.
Thank you, Ranking Member Fong.
I'll determine that to be a comment and not a question at this point or guidance, but short of that, any questions that could be answered by the author or the testifier? If there are none, then any final wrap-up?
Thank you, Chair Sauk. This is a good bill for accessibility. I encourage members to support it, and I'll renew my motion that House File 1152, as amended, be moved to the General Register.
Okay. All those in favor of the bill?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Thank
you. Representative Long?
Representative Long, you want to come forward?
Thanks.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Long. So we have, what do we have? Give me a second to get organized here. House File 1372. I will move House File 1372 to the State Government Finance Committee. If you could please present your bill, Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. So this bill is pretty straightforward. In Minnesota, we like to think of ourselves as having the best election system in the country, but there are a couple of areas where other states are edging us out, and one of those is in the use of permanent absentee balloting. Right now, any Minnesotan can designate themselves as a permanent absentee voter, and lots do. In fact, 24,397 voters have the permanent absentee indicator marked in their voting record. Permanent absentee is particularly appropriate for students, seniors, people with disabilities, people in rural areas, or working parents. And this is an easy way to show that they would prefer to vote absentee in all elections. Most voters likely expect that when they make this designation, they will automatically be sent ballots as an absentee voter. But in fact, they are automatically sent ballot applications before each election, and they have to go through the extra step of filling out these applications every time. This bill would make a simple change to meet the voters' expectations. When someone uses the current Minnesota permanent absentee process, they would now be mailed a ballot in every election. All the other procedural steps of the permanent absentee process would remain unchanged. This would be much easier on voters. For those who choose to vote from home, this would be an added convenience and would let voters cast their ballot in a way that works for them. It would also streamline the process for counties and cities and reduce administrative and financial burdens. The application step is unnecessary when the voter has already designated that this is their preferred method of voting. Under the bill, the elections administrations would not have to send out applications and receive those applications before fulfilling the voter's preference. This model is currently being used successfully in many other states, including Arizona, Montana, and Utah, to mention a few. And the permanent absentee lists are popular options in these states. The bill is supported by the Minnesota Association of County Officers as well as the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Representative Long. I understand we have a slight issue with the effective date since this bill is from last year a technical amendment is in order. So the Mr. Gehring, I think it might be best to have you just read it so everyone knows how it would read.
Mr. Chair, so the effective date on page 7 currently provides that the bill's effective January 1 of 2020, and so the proposed oral amendment would be to on line 7.2 delete January and insert July 1, 2020.
Okay. Yeah, and we've made, I know on some of our other bills we've made this sort of correction to the effective date. Is there any discussion to the amendment though? I just don't want to catch anyone by surprise. Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment carries. I do have one person who has signed up to testify. Yes. If you could please come forward just identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, good morning, everyone. My name is Carrie Sheldon, and I am an election judge, and I do help people with disabilities do voting, but I do would like to stress that there is an issue with when people get their ballots, there is a very strong possibility that they are unable to read the ballots and read the instructions on how exactly it's supposed to go, because it has been my experience that absentee ballots have been destroyed because they're unable to unable to read the instructions on how exactly it's supposed to go. My suggestion would be to have house parties like we do now. I've held at least one, and we're going to be doing another one. But those who don't want to have their ballots or don't want to wait for a certain day, they can, you know, just go ahead. But that's kind of that may or may not work, because those ballots may or may not be counted. So I would urge that we try and find a solution, or at least discuss some kind of a solution so that everybody's vote counts.
Thank you, Ms. Sheldon. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 1372? Okay, seeing none, member discussion. Representative Lehman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Long, kind of following on what the testifier just said, I think the gist of her testimony was that she's thinking that some people that request ballots probably send back ballots that are ineligible because they weren't able to follow the instructions and so on. So my question is, other states are doing this, and I have a permanent list. Do you have any idea of the ratio of people that request ballots to those that actually end up returning ballots? Any idea what the success ratio is?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I don't have that data for other states. I do know that voting absentee is a very popular option, and that in this state it's become popular cycle after cycle, with more folks participating every cycle. The Secretary of State's office may have more specific information, but in terms of spoilage rates, I don't have that in particular. I know that that is a problem. There are folks who don't know exactly how to fill out the systems we have now, and I think that's in some ways a separate issue from what this bill is trying to address, and certainly one that I would support addressing as well. Is if we move, for example, to a pure early vote system rather than a no-excuse absentee voting system, then you would avoid some of the hurdles we have with the double envelope and signature process. But I think this is really just trying to fulfill the intent of voters who have already signed up that they want to be on a permanent absentee list, but may not understand that that requires them to take an extra step every single election to actually get that ballot. I think most folks would assume if you check a box saying I'm a permanent absentee voter, that means you're going to be receiving a ballot going forward, and that's certainly the intent we're trying to fulfill.
Representative Lehman.
Okay, Mr. Chair, and Representative Long, maybe, you know, if this does become law, the Secretary of State's office would want to keep track of that success rate to see if this is really an effective method.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Long. I just wanted to make a personal comment and thank you for this bill. Our stepson moved in with us a few years ago. He's now currently serving as a decorated member of the Marines down in North Carolina. But a few years back, he moved in with us because, unfortunately, his mother suffered from a stroke. And while the body may not be willing, her mind is mentally as sharp as a tack. And I know that she holds her civic responsibility in great regard, and she is very excited about the upcoming election. And this bill gives her the opportunity to continue to receive those ballots in her assisted living facility where she currently resides. And I know that a lot of members around her have a very similar bent. They are very patriotic and really want to participate. So thank you for making this option available and helping us catch up.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question, now that they would be getting a ballot, and I'm not sure how all of the process works, would that list then become public of those people that are on this because they have received a ballot?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel. Not that I'm aware of, I don't believe anybody's ballot selection is public. I know that the Secretary of State does aggregate data for those who have requested early voting and the like, and I'm sure that would be a part of the aggregate data, but not individually identifiable, no.
Okay. Representative Vogel?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe somebody, I'm just not sure, when are you recorded as a voter, I guess is maybe the right question then, because if you're recorded as a voter when you receive a ballot, then would you be looked at as having voted?
I see. I do see Ms. Bonowitz coming up. If you could please identify yourself a third time and respond to the question.
Chair, Member Sam Bonowitz, Office of the Secretary of State. You are marked as a voter when your ballot is accepted. So if you're voting absentee, it's when the canvassing board looks through the envelopes and they make sure that everything checks out, you're registered to vote, you're good to go. That's when your ballot is accepted. And we do keep track of accepted absentee ballots, and that information is available. But it's unclear right now if you could get a list of people on the permanent absentee list. That's something that I would have to check with our council with and with the secretary about.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that answers my question. I guess I didn't know when you were officially counted as voting, when you receive a ballot, or if there's actually in a method where you cast the ballot and it's recorded at that point. And I'm gathering that even if I receive an absentee ballot, doesn't mean that I'm counted as voting. It's just if I indeed fill out the ballot and then it's returned. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. Vice Chair Selk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to share. I'm on a early voting person list continuously, and I think the county may have just decided to continue the convenience of it for anybody who's getting it. So I automatically get the application, which I agree it'd be nice if that step was out, because that's superfluous for me to fill that out year after year after year. But even for the presidential primary that Minnesota has now, I received the invitation, said here, verify that you exist, go through all the steps. They sent me the ballot, and it was exactly as a normal voting procedure and or a normal voting environment in terms of the paper products and all of that sort of thing. And my sense of when did I vote, I suspect I felt like I had voted when my ballot was counted at the county. So as to the occurrence of voting for my, and I would say that appears to be authenticated by the way my ballot is then treated, is like if I show up and try to vote again, that first ballot recorded is the one that blockades my ability to try to vote again, and or they have to sort that out according to their rules. But I think that there are mechanisms that essentially step in terms of timeliness and that sort of thing. But I've received my absentee ballot routinely for the last 3 years, I believe. It's 3 years. So I get the invitation and go right through the procedure every time. It's always the same kind of thing. I do think that there are great improvements. As a person who does participate that way, this has got some steps, and the next step that would come in a pragmatic way would be great appreciated also.
Thank you, Representative Selk. Is there any additional discussion? Okay, seeing none, I will, any closing remarks, Representative Long?
No, I think Representative Sokka summed up nicely what this bill is trying to do, which is, you know, you're one of the 24,000 plus Minnesotans who are taking advantage of this currently, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for you to have to go through an extra step every single election. So we're just trying to streamline the process and help the counties and cities out.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Long. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1372, as amended, be moved to the State Government Finance Division. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Long.
Thank you.
Representative Lucero, sharply dressed as always. I understand, just before you proceed, I understand there was a delete all amendment adopted in the election subcommittee. It's not in our packet at the moment. However, staff is tracking that down. So I will make sure that we've had the opportunity to see it before it happens. I just want to let everyone know what's happening with that. So. Maybe should I hold off on the motion until it's arrived, or okay? If you'd just like to present your bill, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have not seen the DE amendment that was adopted in the earlier committee either, so I'm waiting for that as well. So I will proceed with what I have in front of me, which is presently under campaign finance law. We, as most of us are aware, hopefully all of us actually. We have two types of expenses. We have expenses that are accounted against our campaign finance limits, and then we have non-campaign disbursements. And presently in law, there are 27 of those non-campaign disbursements allowed, whereby we can use our campaign finance or our campaign funds to finance certain things, and again, they don't count against us. What I'm seeking to do is to add a 28th option, which provides for the payment of security-related services while serving in office, including but not limited to home security cameras, home security system, and identity theft monitoring. Now, the reason I submitted this as a bill is because in the last several years, we've seen examples of members having protesters in front of their house. We've had others that have had different types of electronic communications that are concerning. And so I'm seeking to allow us to use our campaign funds to do just that, to have a security camera system, potentially enroll in those identity theft monitoring programs, of which there's many, in order to just provide a greater level of protection, because we are, as elected officials, have a higher visibility. And that's the main thrust of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Is there anyone who would like to testify for or against House File 673? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion? Are you sure? Might yes, Representative Not Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, recently I just had a Nest doorbell installed. Would that possibly be something that would be included as well? Because I did it for security reasons, because my husband and I are both gone a lot. But what was really curious is I had a squirrel on my doorbell monitoring system the other day. But I don't think so. He looked like he was smiling. So I don't think he was protesting. But, you know, it is a concern of mine, and especially in the summertime when we are out a lot. So do you think that could possibly be another thing that could be added to the list?
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that is exactly the intent of what I'm seeking to do. There's the traditional home security systems, but I'm not limiting it to that. It is those security systems which have allowed for cameras such as the doorbell, or there's those similar providers that have cameras all the way around the house with floodlights attached that come to our mobile phone so we can enable and disable them and use the microphone and all that kind of stuff. But that's exactly what I'm trying to accomplish.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm my understanding of non-campaign disbursements or like things that are allowable expenses are expenses that we wouldn't otherwise incur if we weren't in office. Generally, that's kind of like the, and so to me, like, I don't know that example necessarily meets that standard. I'm not, you know, if the concern is about like being out of town a lot and your property rather than like feeling concerned with your security because of being holding elected office. I guess I'm just curious about what that standard is.
Any response, Representative Lucero?
Well, if we look at the, thank you, Mr. Chair, if we look at the other 27 presently in law, there is not a clear line between activities that we will do only as elected officials. There's gray area there. And this would be among that category, which is certainly, can a person get a security system who's not an office holder? Absolutely. But are there members in this room, on this committee, or in the body as a whole that presently don't have a security system as a non-elected official, or prior to being elected, I should say, then feel the need to have a security system, but then as a part of being an elected official, having a raised profile, they now have crossed that threshold where they want to do that. So that's what I'm seeking to accomplish.
Representative Gomez.
Sorry, if I could just a comment. I sort of like to look through people's, you know, campaign finance reports, and I remember finding ones like that was, it's actually not a state level, it was like a local one, where you know, someone was like charging their cable bill at their cabin to like to their campaign and called it like, you know, information for constituents, or like their, you know, newspaper subscription at their cabin. And so I guess I'm just, I don't necessarily have a problem with this. I guess I'm just like, you know, you don't want this to like our campaigns to turn into slush funds for us. And so that's just all I'm kind of concerned about. But to your point, I mean, there maybe isn't like a lot of clarity in this about that threshold between like, what would you need? What would you kind of like be paying for if you were just a citizen versus, you know, being involved in your elected office? So that's just a comment, but I don't think it means that I wouldn't support this necessarily.
We do have a gentleman coming up to speak.
Good to see you again.
Could you please identify yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony?
Hi, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the executive director with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. The amendment, I believe, is trying to address advisory opinion that was issued by the board about 18 months ago that found that there wasn't currently a category that included security provisions. So I believe that's directly what this is in response to.
Thank you. Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the members. Some of you weren't here when this became kind of an issue. Our colleague, Representative Daniels, was literally trapped in his home over a weekend when folks from Isaiah were protesting outside of his home. He lives in a cul-de-sac, and they had a little drum circle because they didn't like one of the positions that he took on a bill. I think that this is a wholly appropriate thing because at one time or another, all of us are probably going to say something that's unpopular with the other side of the aisle that sure. That we might be espousing. It is not unrealistic for us to say, I would never have experienced these things were it not for the fact that I'm a public official. So I think Representative Lucero is doing a really good job on this one. I like the additional protections that you might have for some of your personal personal information, physical security. Again, we take popular or unpopular positions on things, and you will get some people who are on the fringy ends of either position that may want to come out and remind you that you suck, in their opinion. And I think that it's not an inappropriate use of your campaign funds because you never would have been in this position to start off with. So, Representative Lucero, I've supported this since you dropped it on day one. So thanks for bringing this bill.
And the amendment has been distributed, so just so members are aware, I think this is just to reflect the language as it was included in the elections omnibus bill last year, so this makes it consistent with that. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to make a comment. One of the reasons I got it was I was having a lot of signs stolen, and while that necessarily isn't a big deal, it just made me feel like, what's next? And so that was really the reason for it, was the fact that I just didn't expect it to happen. And we do live in a cul-de-sac, so that's a little bit more, you know, back there. So it truly is a concern because I'm in office. If I wasn't in office, I probably wouldn't care if the signs got stolen. Thank you.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the members. In greater Minnesota, many of our communities, we don't lock our front doors. A lot of the security type things that maybe are prevalent in some communities aren't there, so that it would maybe be more unusual to have one of these systems. And frankly, oftentimes it's more for the family. You're worried about your, what might happen to them. I think all of us have come into confrontations with demonstrators or people are passionate in politics, and sometimes passionate people do things they normally wouldn't do. And frankly, what we do, no matter where it's on the list, there, if we abuse it, then the gentleman up there knows that there's a process of where it can come forward. And a former member who is now in Congress discovered that you have to be careful because people are watching. And so, our campaign expenditures are out there, public, visible, and people are looking at it. So anyone, that's watching or out in the public, yes, there is some discretion, but we have a light shining upon us because we're servants of the people. And if we don't use that discretion appropriately, sometimes that light might burn a little bit. But I trust in the intent to provide a reasonable countermeasure to some of the recent overzealous activities from different groups. Politics is not always fun and safe. So I guess I support this bill because I trust you and the other members of our chamber to use it judiciously and appropriately. Thank you.
Thank you, Ranking Member Plum. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is to Mr. Sigerson. If we were able to pass this into law, will the Campaign Finance Board provide us with some guidance on additional security-related expenses that may qualify for this, or what will be the process?
Mr. Sigerson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lee, frankly, as I was sitting here, I was becoming a little bit concerned about the language, including but not limited to. Although the policy decision before the for this committee and for the legislature is whether to allow funds to be used for security-related expenses, the more you have language that's like including but not limited to, the more the board is then forced to make the type of calls that you're talking about. If there was a way of determining a list here, home security cameras, home security system, identity theft monitoring, I don't have the amendment, but I believe those are still included in the amendment. Those are fairly straightforward, and I don't believe the board would have any problem providing guidance on those issues. I'm not sure how we would address the issue, including but not limited to. I mean, would a guard dog be included in that? I'm not sure you want the board to make that call. If a guard dog is included, is the veterinary expenses related to the guard dog included? It does lead you down to a path where it might be best to provide a very specific list, an inclusive list that you believe is appropriate, but a list for the board to operate off of.
Representative, okay. Representative Nash?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just for the process, I would move the DE1 amendment now that we had it in front of us.
Sure. Representative Nash moves the DE1 amendment. Is there any discussion to that?
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Lucero?
I don't think the bill's been moved yet.
You're correct. I think you are correct.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson?
Maybe Mr. Guerin can have questions, but I understanding that this was passed, the DE1 amendment was added in the last stop. Do we need to adopt it at this committee, or do we? I guess that's the question I have for Mr. Guerin.
Mr. Guerin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, so this DE1 was adopted in the election subcommittee, but you don't have the subcommittee engrossment in front of you, so the cleanest way to address that is just to re-adopt the DE1 here and create a new engrossment from this committee.
Okay, with that understanding, I will move that House File 673 be recommended to pass to the General Register. Now, Representative Nash, would you care to move the amendment?
I would move the DE1.
Okay, Representative Nash moves the DE1. Is there any discussion to that? Okay, seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Was that your only?
I'm good.
Okay, all right, sounds good. Representative Heinrich?
Pass.
Pass. Okay, any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, I will, any closing remarks, Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate your support.
Okay, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 673 as amended be moved to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Anything else we need to do? Okay. There's nothing else on the agenda. Seeing no additional member discussion, this meeting is adjourned.